TNT Radio wants to know what you really think, because your opinion matters. At TNTRadio.live, upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. You're listening to The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Mutual assured destruction. That terrifying policy of the Soviet Union pointing all their nukes at us and us pointing all our nukes at the Soviet Union was supposed to make us sleep soundly at night, knowing that they won't attack us, because if they do, they would be destroyed. And we won't attack them, because if we do, they will destroy us. Mutual assured destruction. Well, the world survived that policy, and I guess in hindsight it worked, right? Wasn't so great to live through, but it worked. Nobody attacked anybody. Well, there's a new MAD threat facing the world, and there's a great book, The Fifth Horseman and the New MAD, M-A-D, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large. The author, Dr. Robert Ullman, is a globally recognized thought leader and strategic thinker. He's senior advisor to the Atlantic Council. He's also UPI's Arnaud de Borchgrave's distinguished columnist. He's come up with the concepts of shock and awe, a brains-based approach to strategic thinking, and the aforementioned massive attacks of disruption. Welcome, Dr. Ullman.
Timothy, it's good to be with you, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
Like your predecessor tonight, I just had on Dr. Rob Spalding, who's a former Air Force guy. You're a former sailor and swift boat skipper in Vietnam, so thank you for your service.
Well, we didn't win that war.
Well, it wasn't your fault. Over 150 combat missions. You went on to command a destroyer in the Persian Gulf in the first Gulf War. You advise heads of government and industry, and you've chaired several companies. You've had quite a distinguished career. I look back at the Vietnam War, and you know, I had a cousin that was there, and still has invisible injuries from it. I don't know that we had the political will to win that war. We certainly had the political will to prosecute that war. They kept buying bombs and planes and dropping them. But I don't know whether we actually had the will to win that war.
I think, Timothy, that the great lesson, if there's such a thing as a great lesson, that we take away from that, and it's really central to my book, The Fifth Horseman, what we got wrong not only in Vietnam, but we got wrong in Afghanistan, what we got wrong the second time in Iraq, was a profound misunderstanding of the nature of the war and the adversaries. We tend to think people think like Americans. And as I go into my book, and I have three chapters on President Putin and Xi, because I think we misunderstand what's happening. And China is a really vivid example. The riots in China are not new. There are over 100,000 riots a year, not quite as sizable. And we don't understand that what President Xi has done is to do what I call a reverse Gorbachev. I write about this in my book. Gorbachev knew that the Soviet Union was brittle, and the only way he could make it work was through glasnost and perestroika, openness and restructuring. And so he opened the country. And in so doing, he destroyed it. Xi has taken the opposite effect, a reverse Gorbachev. He's shutting it down. He's killing off the entrepreneurial spirit that enabled its economy to grow at 10, 15% a year. And with all these lockdowns over COVID, he's enraging his nation. Now, there's not going to be a revolution. There's not going to be a series of continued riots. The party and the apparatus will back up Xi, and they'll put these things down. But China's got some real problems. They're internal problems. And unless the economy can grow, China is in for a very rough ride. We don't understand that. We don't understand there's a war in Ukraine, in Europe, and yet China is the leading threat. So one of the arguments I make in my book is that we have it backwards. I challenge people to tell me what the threat is from China. Some people will say, well, China can invade Taiwan. Oh, really? How are they going to get there? Normandy, the 6th of June, 1944, 6,000 landing craft, 200,000 soldiers and sailors from four or five different countries. And Normandy is as flat as it could be. Taiwan is Norway in an island. And so the notion of an amphibious assault against Taiwan is almost preposterous. Now, China's got all sorts of other things they can do. An economic blockade, a no-fly zone, great pressure threatens to obliterate the island working from within. But as I argue in my book, we don't fully understand China or Russia. We don't understand Putin. We don't understand President Xi. And so I argue that many of our policies are flawed. And about massive—
I'd like to dig into that. Yeah, let's dig into that. You're listening to The Reckoning on TNT Radio.
Talking the big stories.
Our country has a lot of problems.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. My guest this hour, Dr. Harlan Ullman, is the author of The Fifth Horseman and the New Mad, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large. Dr. Ullman, before the break, we were saying that we don't understand Xi, we don't understand Putin. Let's dig into that. What do you think we get wrong about each of those men?
We don't understand the nature of the culture and what they're doing. In my book, I document virtually every major speech that Putin has given, starting with the millennial address he made on January 1st, 2000, and what the United States and its allies did through the expansion of NATO, but through the abrogation of all sorts of treaties, at the Bucharest NATO summit in 2008, when George W. Bush promised membership to Ukraine and Georgia. In essence, we forced Putin to realize that the United States and the West were not friendly. Now, I'm not blaming us, but what I'm saying is we did not understand what our actions were going to do that culminated in what's happening in Ukraine. And we don't understand right now in Ukraine, Putin's strategy is to win by not losing. He cannot win on the ground. The Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian public have performed almost miraculously. And so Putin is doing what we did in World War II in the strategic bombing campaigns of Japan and Germany to punish the civilian sector as much as possible to try to end the war. And that's what Putin is doing. We need a counter strategy. And my counter strategy is threaten to take Crimea away from Russia. That, I think, would lead to negotiations, because that's the one thing that Putin cannot tolerate. He cannot tolerate such a great, great setback. But my point is, and you made a note of brains-based approach to strategic thinking, we don't understand the adversary as well as we should. We just do not have sufficient knowledge and understanding. It never is going to be perfect, but it can be pretty good. And so we tend to think that people think like us, and not everybody thinks like us. The other problem we face, and interestingly, it's the problem that President Xi, President Putin, and President Biden face. The biggest challenges and dangers they face are at home. I've got a series of three articles that are coming out in my Hill column. Last week, I talked about President Xi and the reverse Gorbachev. This week's column on Putin argued that Putin is putting in place a Soviet-style leadership and management and command and control without the apparatus to control the state, and it's going to hurt him. And in the United States, Joe Biden has to deal with a broken American society, not a threat to democracy, a broken American society. We are about to spend, Timothy, $1.7 trillion on three pieces of legislation: the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and the wrongly named Inflation Reduction Act. Simple question: who is in charge of making sure this money is going to be well spent? I argue in my book, we need a chief operating officer to make sure the government runs well. But who is in charge? Who is going to provide the oversight? And who's going to report back to Congress and the American public that this money is being spent for good purposes? Question. And I would apply this to almost any administration, not just the Biden administration. It's one of the flaws of American government.
Yeah, I think that you're assuming that there's any desire to see that the money's well spent. I don't think that that's the case at all. Washington has been spending like a drunken sailor the last 20 years. And this idea of just printing our way to prosperity,
Well, it's divided
government. I can't believe that people haven't put a stop to it.
Well, I think the problem here, Timothy, is that the Constitution is under profound assault. The Constitution,
it absolutely is.
It only works with one of three conditions is in place. One, that one party controls both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue with a veto-proof majority and at least five seats in the Supreme Court. That never happened, not even under Roosevelt. Second, a crisis like Pearl Harbor rallies the nation. But COVID, that's killed twice as many Americans that died in battle in World War II, divided the nation. Or you have civility and compromise. And you listen to the 118th Congress as it will form in January, and please tell me where civility and compromise are there. So we have a broken system. And I argue in my book how we can fix both branches, including putting in place a chief operating officer. So the $1.7 trillion in this case is spent wisely. That's not happening. And as I said, this happens under administrations of Republican or Democrat. The country is just not well managed today. And I go into my book to explain why that's the case and how we fix it. We have to get competent people who were selected not for political reasons or campaign contributions, but because they want to serve their government. And quite frankly, too many people are appointed to government because they raise money because of ideological views of left or right. And we're simply not getting the best and the brightest as we once had. And by the way, the best and the brightest don't always work. They worked during World War II, but that was the rare exception.
Sure didn't work during Vietnam.
You can say that again. Believe me, I know firsthand.
Yeah. I mean, that was best and brightest was LBJ's slogan for the brain trust he had around it. And they really, they couldn't have done worse if they tried, I don't think. Now, I'm fascinated by the idea. What's that?
Anyway, go ahead.
I'm fascinated by this idea of reorganizing the government. What are you proposing?
Well, it's really, look, first of all, the U.S. cabinet and the executive branch is organized the way it was under George Washington. Why do we have a Department of Agriculture? How many independent farmers do we have in America? They're not statistically relevant. Why do we have a Department of Education? It's knowledge and learning. That's what counts. Where's our Department of Industry and Technology? All right, Commerce, Department of Interior. It should be Human Resources. This has got to be organized for the 21st century. It's got to be leaner. It has to have somebody who's in charge to make sure that these departments work together, not in opposition. We don't do that.
I'd also like to see it outside D.C. I thought that was one of the ideas that President Trump tried that, you know, I wish he'd succeeded.
That's not going to work. That's not going to work because it's a seat of government. That doesn't work in any country. That's just not going to physically.
You know, I think my thesis is that any nation where six of the top 10 wealthiest counties surround the nation's capital and none of those people make a thing, that's a problem.
Name me one country where that's not the case.
Well, I just look at Brazil, right? Brasilia is the wealthiest place in Brazil, and you've got Sao Paulo and you've got Rio de Janeiro, but you know, Brasilia is where all the money is, and it's an artificial city, just like Washington, D.C., except instead of being located on a nice river on the East Coast, it's literally out in the middle of the jungle. So you're right.
Say that again.
But, you know, let's try something different, okay? Just because it's the same way everywhere, let's try something different. I'd like to see interior out in Colorado. I'd like to see agriculture out in Iowa.
I'd like to see both of them eliminated. I don't think we need them.
Even better.
We need new organization. Same thing with Congress. You've got literally dozens of committees and subcommittees. I understand why. But where is the overarching committee to coordinate Congress? There needs to be the equivalent of a National Security and Economic Council for Congress, of the leadership of both houses. And they should have a seat on the National Security Council staff as observers so that Congress is on in for the takeoff as well as the landing. There's got to be closer coordination between both branches. We're dealing in an era right now.
The problem with that is look what happens anytime you give Congress, either party, a piece of classified information. It's on Twitter within 5 seconds.
I don't, No, I don't agree with that. I think that you can, under certain circumstances, you can deal with that. Of course, you could make the argument. You can do that with the president of the United States, as Donald Trump did, with all the classified information he had. But that's a different issue.
What classified information? There are 25 documents. Yeah, but no, we're talking 25 documents that he says he declassified. But even if he didn't, he still holds the national security clearance.
For which, if you or I had them, you and I would be in.
No, he still has he has a security clearance. He gets.
No, I don't want to debate you. Security briefings. Not the law. Sorry.
Obama has 30,000 documents. He won't even let the National Archives know what he has. 30,000.
No, that's not true. But let's get off that. Situation. The point is, in my book, Massive Attacks of Disruption, whether acts of man or acts of nature, COVID, we discussed that. Climate change and weather. The Colorado River is now a creek. Headline in the Washington Post, there's no water in California. These are serious issues that have got to be met seriously. And quite frankly, the government, both parties, is not rising to the challenge. We have virtually unlimited technology. So please tell me, in this $1.7 trillion, where are we putting money in new technologies? Where are we putting money in education, knowledge, and learning? We're not. And it's going to be these technologies, whether it's artificial intelligence or something else, that are going to save the day. So where is our Department of Technology? We don't have one.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. We spoke last hour about how bad our infrastructure is, our physical infrastructure, our digital infrastructure. It's a mess. And neither party has the solution. It's two wings of the same dirty bird. Have a fascinating conversation. Want to pick it up after the break? You're listening to The Reckoning on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan.
So what does it say about an industry that even has need for such a position? I mean, it's not as if, I'm going to work for McDonald's as the counterterrorism finance manager. It implies already that there was a risk within the system that they should have been aware of and been working against.
It was all window dressing. It looks, on face value that the organisation is committed to do the right thing, but an industry with so much money being involved, going through the machines, going through the various clubs, one would think there's a lot of money to go around at $95 billion, but the majority of these clubs don't want to spend the money simply on putting these programs in place and I found there was a lot of cutting the corners with that.
McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and they can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization, the left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left were trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, about old white men are a problem. Except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden, then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at salemnow.com.
Hunter Biden, Where are you hiding? House Republicans are looking for you. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to The Reckoning. My guest this hour, Dr. Harlan Ullman, is a columnist for The Hill. You can check his work out at thehill.com. He's also the author of The Fifth Horseman and The New Mad, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large. You can get your copy at Amazon. I love your Fifth Horseman reference. Of course, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And now we've got a Fifth Horseman of, I'm assuming you're implying that there's a looming apocalypse. Massive Attacks of Disruption implies an attacker. Now, you've got a great line here. Beyond traditional threats from states such as China, Russia, and non-state actors employing violent extremism, can America's politics and political system withstand the assaults of the Fifth Horseman in the new MAD, Massive Attacks of Disruption? Who do you see as the Fifth Horseman, Doctor?
Well, the Fifth Horseman is really the analogy, the avatar for carrying the weapon of MAD. But the most dangerous, let's list seven disruptors. The most dangerous is failed and failing government. And that applies not just to the United States, but elsewhere. That's what disrupting everything. If we had a government that was more sensible, then I think we could deal with a lot of these issues. But because it's so divided and can agree on virtually nothing, that's the big issue. The other disruptors include climate change, which I think potentially is existential. We don't have evidence of that yet, but we need to worry about it. Then there's social media, there's cyber, there's terror. There are drones, which are going to be really very, very difficult. You can imagine what happens when people decide they want to have their own drones for self-protection and debt.
Who watched The Terminator and thought that Skynet was a good idea? I can't believe we're talking about putting weapons on drones, you know, over America.
Well, listen, no, Timothy, supposing you want to guard children going to school, so forth and so on, you could have a bodyguard. In many ways, an autonomous bodyguard, whether it's a robot or a drone, could be armed and would be far more effective than an individual. Now, people will say that's preposterous, but people didn't think 10 or 15 years ago that drones would be playing the role in warfare that they are.
Artificial intelligence, facial recognition technology, and you know.
You bet. Absolutely. The technology is here right now. I mean, I've got more technology in my Lexus than existed in humanity 10 years ago. And so all these things are possible.
I've got more technology. I've got more computing power in my fingers here, my two fingers, than NASA had when they sent a man to the moon and returned him safely to Earth.
Absolutely. And so we have to learn to deal with this. Take, for example, FTX and cryptocurrency, which I think is rather like the 17th century tulips. I think this is going to be a bust. But look at what this has done. And now you take the expansion of technology and social media and all these different platforms and the fact that every 2 years we're doubling the capacity of chips. And there are issues here that we simply are not able to deal with. We still cannot deal with guns. We still have not resolved the Second Amendment. So please tell me how we're going to deal with artificial intelligence.
Whoa. I got to pick up on that. What's to be resolved about the Second Amendment?
Look, there's a huge, I'm not taking a position. I'm just saying the Second Amendment is extremely debatable right now on both sides. What I'm saying is that it's going to be even more complex. Or take any of these particular issues that divide society on abortion or right to choose. Huge divisions. What happens now? We're getting into technology with artificial intelligence that opens all these things up. Unless we have competent government, we're going to be creating greater and greater political divides as technology offers greater capability. I go into this in my book, but without any necessary charts to see how we can deal with it. These are huge unknowns.
You just alluded to something that I frequently reference, which is Moore's Law, which 1965, Gordon Moore posited roughly every 2 years, the number of transistors on microchips will double. And we've seen that. But eventually, we're going to reach a physical limit, right? It's going to be impossible to go beyond. But how do you see quantum computing changing the game?
That's the answer. That is, quantum computing is really interesting because in quantum computing, you actually can have individual things that can be in two places at once, which defy physics. And so what happens when you exceed Moore's law, when you can't double or have enough, then quantum computing which is multi-dimensional, will add to the ability to generate more and more information and knowledge. Now, how this is going to work out remains to be seen.
And speed. And speed.
Absolutely. Of course. For example, I'm engaged in a particular company that's dealing with information technologies, but it has the capacity, a system, to be able to analyze enormous numbers of gigabits that are in so-called portfolios of knowledge and pick out, for example, almost instantaneously, specific bits of information out of many, many billions, trillions of bytes.
Literally finding a needle in a haystack.
Absolutely.
Finding a digital needle in a haystack, yeah.
Precisely. The technology is here. And as long as you have political divisions, how do you deal with some of these particular issues? This worries not me, but it's going to worry people in 10, 20, or 50 years from now. And unless we have the political governing system in place to deal with it, that's why these changes are important. That's why improving our technological base is important. These are going to be extraordinarily revolution. They're going to make Gutenberg's press and the cell phone look primitive in the future. How you put your mind around this, though, is an interesting proposition.
Now, I'm worried about the trans crisis, the real trans crisis facing the world today. And of course, that's not transsexuals, it's transhumanism. How do you see the digital computing working within the transhumanist movement?
Well, when you're talking about the ability for people to work with artificial intelligence, there are several very interesting things about artificial intelligence. I go into this in my book, The Fifth Horseman. The advantage of artificial intelligence is that it will come up to non-human solutions. In other words, solutions that humans themselves would not decide to use. But that doesn't mean humans don't understand that. Where artificial intelligence cannot substitute, artificial intelligence is not able to be conceptual as human beings, nor is innovative. What makes artificial intelligence so powerful is that it can analyze huge amounts of information, compare, test, so forth and so on. But that's almost mechanical. So it lacks the innovative ability of a human brain. So that means even if we can't understand how AI works and does these kinds of things, I'm far less worried about, you referenced Skynet. I don't think that's going to happen. But of course, we have to be able to deal with the moral and ethical and legal aspects of this. And we're not prepared. And that's why we need to modernize our government for the 21st century. I said we're still organized as it was under George Washington. That's got to change. And over time, as I argue in my book, I think that that can be done. But people need to be thinking that about that right now. And very, very few people are.
I find the idea fascinating. It's new to me, and I'd like to dig into that a little bit. Do you still see three branches, or do you see a complete overhaul?
Well, that's a really good question. I hope at some stage we're going to get somebody running for president who's going to take my idea that the vice president needs to be the chief operating officer, which means that person has to be basically nonpartisan, even though a member of a political party, acceptable to the other political party, and competent. Because look, a president has too many responsibilities. He or she is the leader of a party, head of state, head of government, and the leader of the nation. And quite frankly, is too busy to get the nuts and bolts of a chief operating officer. So I think that should be the role of the vice president, who also sits, and the only person in the Constitution who's got a legal role in both the executive and legislative branches. Vice President, as you know, is President of the Senate.
President of the Senate.
Now, Dick Cheney tried to do this under George W. Bush. He not only had an office in the Senate, he had an office in the House. And where he got out of control, of course, was dominating Bush, getting us into Iraq and all these other things. But you need to get somebody who can manage the government. And once we do that, we can then begin to impose major reform. So I said, you go into the Congress, you know, and it's still organized as it was 250 years ago, more or less. Obviously, there are new committees to meet new technologies. And so we need to update that. And I think that that's something that will happen over time. But it's got to be done in a way that is nonpartisan, not bipartisan, nonpartisan, so that one side doesn't see the advantage. But unless we modernize and reform our government, how do you deal with the 21st century with a 19th century form of government? You know, in an ideal world, write the Constitution, as Thomas Jefferson said, the Constitution should be rewritten every generation. You take a look at some of the amendments, Seventh Amendment, any case valued more than $35 goes to a jury. Well, that's preposterous. They never talk about judges serving. They talk about judges serving for life because in those days, what was life expectancy? 43, 44.
Yeah.
Nobody thought you
could.
Well,
I certainly would like to see. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to see the repeal of 16A and 17A get states a role back in the government. Now, under your COO arrangement, do you see the vice president being elected separately, the way several states elect their lieutenant governor separately?
No, it would be part on the same. That would be too difficult. This can be done without a constitutional amendment because I don't think we're going to get any amendments. And what it means is that the president sets the policy and then says, okay, Vice President Shea, make sure that the Commerce and the Interior Department make this work. I don't want to hear any complaining from those guys. Fix it. And that's what that person
will
do.
I like your solution better, though. Let's get away with the Commerce and the Interior Department. Let's have a Department of Science and Industry and Technology.
Of course. Innovation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you need somebody to make sure it works. And in the cabinet, everybody is basically equal, even though the Secretary of State nominally is more senior. You have a chief of staff, but the chief of staff is not elected and not confirmed. And he or she is only as powerful as the president. You got the office and management and budget, but that only applies to the budget. So you need somebody who can reconcile these cabinet differences when everybody is equal. I mean, it's ABC management.
That's something I wanted. Yeah, because right now we have a Congressional Budget Office and we've got the Office of Management and Budget. In your regime, do you see them coordinating? Do you see them one as one entity, still two?
No. I see separation of powers, but the coordinator is the vice president, who has a role at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. That's why you need somebody. You ask, you know, who would be potential people to do that? I think Agnes King, former governor of Maine, who's an independent, who's a senator, would be ideal. You know, he is a stalwart. He knows how to do these things. There are people like that who are not political. Now, the way that you can destroy my argument is the two most dangerous words in the English language, Kamala Harris. I would not like to see Kamala Harris, despite her strengths, chief operating officer. That would not work. I'm being generous.
You found a single strength, much less plural strengths?
I'm being generous. But my point
is... She cackles very well. I can give Kamala that. She cackles very well.
But my point is it would completely change
the
nature.
But I love this idea, though, because then the role of CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is to mark up legislation, and the economists there rate it based on how much it's truly going to cost.
Right.
And then OMB and the executive is tasked with making it work. So if you had the vice president coordinating these, you could say, okay, Congress, CBO says this legislation won't work, make it work. So you're not going to get a bill that isn't going to pass through the CBO and isn't going to be quote unquote affordable. And then once it's down, now it's up. It's incumbent on the executive to spend the money wisely. So it's like, okay, here's this pot of money, and
Absolutely.
It's got some strings attached, but you got to do it right, and that's going to be OMB's job. And if the vice president's overseeing OMB, I really like this idea.
Well, it's the only way I think you can make the government work, given the fact that having a constitutional amendment simply is not going to happen. No, we can't really pass serious enough legislation, unfortunately, that's going to make that change. That's the only thing I've seen that I think really makes sense. And it's one of the major, obviously, recommendations of the book. But there are lots of others that get into education, training. How do we do things differently? We need a new national defense strategy, a new national security strategy. The notion of this fixation on China as a pacing threat. You know, if you were China or Russia and you were declared the enemy by somebody, how would you react?
Sure.
I mean, this is just crazy.
Look,
and it doesn't mean you don't have a very strong military. You have a very strong military. But let me make a couple of points here for your audience, Timothy. We cannot afford the military we want because inbuilt cost growth due to inflation and just the cost of increasing technology is running at somewhere between 10 to 15% a year. That means for an $800 billion defense budget, unless you spend an extra $100, $120 billion a year, you're going to lose. And by the way, you cannot retain enough people because only about a third of Americans are qualified to serve in the military, physically, morally, or any other way else. So how do you man a military of 1.4 million? This is unsustainable, and we're going to head for a hollow force in the future through no fault of the Department of Defense. What does that tell you? It means you're going to have to spend less and have fewer people. So let's put in place a strategy to do that. And I do that in my book. It's called a porcupine strategy, which basically says Russia's going to be prevented from getting outside of Russia's boundaries, as Ukraine is showing brilliantly. And similarly with China, they're not going to get beyond the first island chain. And let's stop calling them enemies. Let's just say this is what we can do. And then we go forward with forms of negotiation and diplomacy to work out areas of mutual agreement, nuclear arms reduction, environment, all these other things. And where we don't agree, we say we don't agree and we draw red lines. This is very rational. But unfortunately,
I like it. Yeah. No. And calling them enemies sure is going to get, you know, a bad reaction, just like running a color revolution in Ukraine in 2014 got a bad reaction.
Absolutely.
I want to get back to, though, talking about where the Secretary of Treasury fits into your schema, though, because I really like this idea of having the vice president be a COO responsible for making legislation work. You're listening to The Reckoning on TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
Well, it's Thanksgiving over in the United States. I have a Rocky Balboa attitude. For those of you who saw Rocky 1, remember that one scene?
Yeah, it's Thanksgiving to you. It's Thursday to me.
Well, it's Thursday to me. All right, the weather doesn't stop. You think the weather is going to sit there and go, oh, well, let's see, it's Thanksgiving, it's Boxing Day, it's Christmas. No, the weather never stops. And we continue to see this evolution of what is going to be significant and major cold setting up for December for much of the United States, Europe, and the Far East. Now, for Australia, I got good news for you. I think this cold pattern is going to reverse. And I think that as you go into December, you're actually going to start feeling like summer there. But the big three, as far as energy consumption goes, the Far East, Europe, and much of the United States, in about a week, they're all going into the deep freeze. This is climate and weather watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
My therapist had told me that I needed to go to AA meetings, but I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was not what I wanted to grow up and be. I didn't want to go to AA, but I did, and it wasn't what I expected by any means. It was friendly. I could feel it. I mean, I could feel the happiness. It's really great.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
As a physician, how can you look into the eyes of a pregnant woman and tell her the vaccine is safe?
It's unconscionable.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to The Reckoning. My guest this hour, Dr. Harlan Ullman, is the author of The Fifth Horseman and the New Mad, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large. You can get your copy on Amazon. Dr. Ullman, I'm fascinated by this idea of having the vice president act as a COO of the country and having CBO score legislation and having OMB at the other end of Pennsylvania responsible for good stewardship and implementing it in a budget-minded way. Where do you see the Secretary of State or the Secretary of the Treasury fitting in this regime?
You'll love this. We don't have a chief financial officer. So the Secretary of the Treasury has another duty. He's the chief financial officer, but there's a different wrinkle. You haven't talked about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is
my third political wish is end the Fed. Yeah.
Is fundamentally flawed. Why? It's got two goals. Inflation at 2% or less and maximum employment or minimum unemployment. That doesn't work. Pick one. My one right. would be inflation. But as long as you have these two contradictions, the Fed is not fully empowered. And by the way, for Secretary of the Treasury, my view is somebody who really is highly competent to do that. Hank Paulson, Jim Baker, somebody who really understands. I have no problem with Janet Yellen, but she's too much of an academic. I want somebody who's a real heavyweight and seen as a heavyweight.
Yeah, I want somebody from the street.
The gravitas of cabinet appointees. Look, we can fault Jack Kennedy's cabinet, but Jack really wanted to get the best and brightest. He did not know that Bob McNamara was a Republican. It didn't bother him. He wanted the best. And we need to get people that have got reputations that are just heavyweight. They are impressive. So when the pygmies of the far left and the far right start picking on these people, they're going to be engaged in a heavyweight fight that they can't deal with. We need to up the standards of our appointees. That's not going to happen overnight, because why would you want to serve in government? If you come into government to do well, you're just going to get tarnished. That's got to change.
Yeah. That's the weakness I see in this, is realpolitik.
Yep.
Who are these heavyweights going to be? The heads of our woke corporations? I mean, somebody like Jack Welch? Jack Welch was the hero of the business world, and turns out he wasn't such a great businessman after all.
Of course.
Somebody like Lee Iacocca, I think, would be fantastic. But honestly, I look out at corporate America these days. Can you name one Lee Iacocca, much less enough to serve in government?
Yeah, I can. I'm because some of these people are my friends. I'm not going to name a number of people, but of course you can. But you got to be very, very, very careful. I mean, for example, you have to avoid. I'm fascinated by FTX and Sam, whatever his name is, Bankman-Fried. How this guy was able to con billions of dollars on this scheme, I find fascinating. It was like
we
said
the same thing about Bernie Madoff and Charles Ponzi.
On this scheme, I find fascinating. It was
said the same thing about Bernie Madoff and Charles Ponzi.
Well, no, but Madoff was somewhat different because he was. But here, this guy was able to do this. I find it interesting. And then this is the case. This is a case for much tighter oversight. I think that the SEC has really got to be empowered to prevent this sort of happening. It's a problem, but we need to make sure. I also believe, by the way, you're familiar with the rules that require a head of a public company to be able to state that everything that he or she says in terms of records and so forth are truthful, right?
Right, right.
The law requires that.
Go to prison if they're not.
We need the same kind of law for government.
Oh my goodness, would that be great?
And also,
when I tell people there's an actual law on the books that says it's okay for them to lie if they're in Congress, they can't be arrested and they can't be sued for anything they do in the well of the Senate or on the House of the floor, people don't believe me. And then they go check it out. They're like, how can this possibly be the way that we're running our country?
Well, I have a better one in my book. I think that before any member of Congress votes on a bill, he or she have to swear or affirm that they have read and understood that legislation before voting.
Now, but the before problem you start- isn't with the rank and file members, though. It's not that the members don't read it. The leadership is giving them, if they give them anything, they give them 5 minutes, but they do the DC dipsy doodle. They'll pass legislation. They'll mark up legislation.
And write it.
Right? So it goes through committee. It's all marked up, everything else. And then at the last minute, they keep the title. They completely gut the legislation, completely replace every provision. It's still the same title. They give it to the members to vote on. Members think they're voting on the bill that they just marked up, and it's 100% different. It's the DC dipsy doodle, and it's got to be illegal.
And here's how you stop it. You have to swear or affirm you read and understood. By the way, when Don Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense the first time in 1973, the Defense Authorization Act was 93 pages long. We had 3.5 million people in uniform and were fighting a war in Vietnam. How long is the Defense Authorization Bill today.
Oh, it's like 1,500, 1,600 pages. And they do things like in 2012, sneak through the Smith-Mundt Repeal Act. And then in 2016, they sneak through the Global Engagement Center provisions. Yeah.
And so there actually, I agree with the Global Engagement Center, but that's for a different reason. But the fact of the matter
I agree with what they say it's for, but I don't agree with what they're actually using it for.
Well, my point here is that the way you get around that is members have to say they read and understood what they're voting on. That will change everything. Will we do it?
Yeah.
No, but that's something that needs to be done because you're absolutely right.
And let's also make it a permanent standing rule that each bill can only address one topic. No more of these omnibus bills.
Well, I think, unfortunately, the situation is such that's the only way stuff gets, because we're on continuing resolutions. And by the way, what people don't understand, get back to the Defense Department, a continuing resolution, especially one that's persisted this long and could go on for the entire year, probably will take about 20% of the spending authority away from the Pentagon because it offers virtually no flexibility. I mean, this right. has to be devised by the KGB because no rational American would allow a continuing resolution to stay in place.
Khrushchev is laughing. He said 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we will destroy you from within.
Well, actually, that was Lenin. We'll provide you the rope. And as I said earlier...
But Gorbachev was parroting Lenin, but Gorbachev said it too. He's, we're gonna take you down from within.
Well, that's as I said. The biggest threat Joe Biden faces is broken American society. And what's interesting when you take a look at successive generations from the Depression generation, the Greatest Generation, to Generation Z, you have some social upheavals here that we do not fully comprehend. And you overlay that with a political system that has so divided the country between red and blue. Now, here's an interesting statistic that to me is indicative. And I say this as a nonpartisan. I don't mean bipartisan, nonpartisan. Why is it that more registered Republicans by a significant number have died of COVID than Democrats? That is statistically true. And it suggests something must be wrong somewhere. And I haven't found an equal statistic for the Democrats, but I'm sure it shows the divisions in this country.
Well,
that are really serious.
Now you're in my bailiwick because I'm a biologist and chemist by training. My first question is, have they? Because we've seen how many quote unquote COVID deaths that were listed as COVID deaths because of the spiff that the government gave them weren't COVID deaths. And secondly, how many of them died in hospital after being treated with remdesivir and a ventilator? I have a podcast, MAGA Institute, Do No Harm, where we're talking about all those cases. And
but I think if the total
flip side too, we also need to look at, I think I found your statistic, how many Republicans are dying suddenly as compared to Democrats. I think there's your reverse statistic.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one, but my point is it shows how this country is so divided. And what's interesting, the results of the election was not, in my mind, that democracy was at risk. It was American society was at risk because of the extremes of left and right. And what the electorate did in large cases was reject the more extremes left and right. But just because you got rid of extremists doesn't mean you've gotten rid of extremism. And it persists.
Yeah, I talk about this. I grew up, my cousins ran the Democrat Party in Syracuse, and our neighbors out to the lake, our next door neighbors ran the Republican Party. So I'm literally in politics for 54 years. My first campaign was 1968, leafleting with my dad out door to door. And I saw behind the curtain from a very early stage. I pegged the tipping point at 1972, the radicals that were outside the Democrat convention. People forget that the riots at the political convention in 1968 were outside the Democrat convention in Chicago. Many of those radicals, the Alinsky-inspired radicals, were on the floor as delegates in 72. We got George McGovern, who was pretty extreme for those days. But it used to be that we went out into the world united. Politics stopped at water's edge. That's long gone. It used to be that on both left and right, we said, I disagree with what you say, but I'll defend with my life your right to say it. Yep. The left has completely obliterated that. The right still abides by that, believe it or not. But the left wants to censor and shut down and cancel and deplatform. I'm in Facebook jail now because there was an election. So every election, I have to go into Facebook jail. Happened in 16, happened in 18, happened in 20, happened in 22 now. And I'm in this time because I posted the picture of Hunter in his underwear with his red scarf around. They will protect Hunter at all costs. And there was a guy on Twitter who said, oh, so if you happen to leave your laptop at a repair shop and somebody it's going to be quote unquote your porn that they find on the computer. And I came back and I said, dude, not Hunter's porn. They were selfie videos of him smoking either crack or meth with a hooker getting a footy naked on his own computer. What do you mean it was not his porn? And 12-hour ban on Twitter for that, because they will protect Hunter at all costs. We got to end this.
Let me make two points. One that's serious, the other's not. How would you like to have Hunter Biden for your son? I could not think of a greater tragedy, quite frankly.
How would you like to have Joe Biden as your dad? I feel sorry for Hunter.
I like Joe Biden. I disagree with a lot of stuff. No, but you know, Hunter Biden is a tragedy I would not wish on anybody. Having said that, I date the decline of America on the 7th of August, 1964, when the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed by both houses of Congress with only two dissenting votes. At that stage, roughly 80% of Americans trusted the government. So here we are almost 60 years later, 80% of Americans think we're on the wrong track and can't stand government. That was the beginning.
Yeah, I was pegging it for the civility thing, but I think with trust in government, you're right, that Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was a tipping point. I think so many lies, right? You can only, Abraham Lincoln really, he might have been just a country lawyer, but he really had a sense of humanity and human nature. And man alive, did he ever get it right when he said, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And I think we've been lied to so often by our own government, and so many psyops have been run on us, and so many medical experiments, whether it's CIA spraying LSD in the subways in New York, or Tuskegee experiment, or the Milgram experiment up at Yale, all of these things. Do you think
and truth
there's
in fact
any hope? Yeah. Do you think there's any hope that
there has to
the
be.
American the electorate way, as a whole, left and right, will ever trust the government again?
It's going to take a long time, but that's why you need competent people who tell the truth. And when there's and you can't just say you lied because you made a mistake. You have to be able to explain. And one of the problems of government is people do not explain. Joe Biden has not been able, though I think his last press conference was about the best he's had, because he did make some explanations. We're spending $1.7 trillion on these three bills. Okay, who is going to stand up and tell me what's in these bills? What is it going to achieve? Why is it going to work? The government has
not. Well, as you pointed out, the infrastructure bill doesn't address infrastructure. The Inflation Reduction Act doesn't reduce inflation. You know, it's all up is down, left is right, and right is wrong. It's crazy.
And both sides have got to come to some agreement that there is the basis for truth. In fact, I go into this in my book about how we're able to do that. But look, this society has got huge strength, Timothy. But it's got huge weaknesses that we do not understand, which are exploited, as I noted in my book, by massive attacks of disruption. Are we ready for COVID 20 or 21? No. Why not? Please tell me. And the reason is the number one disruptor is government. We should have in place right now some kind of mechanism to deal with these massive attacks of disruption. We're not prepared for climate change and all these weather extremes. We're not protecting the infrastructure seriously that we're spending money. These are things that can be done. They're not sending people to the moon. They require management. They require common sense. And those virtues, unfortunately, are lacking right now. and my book argues.
Yeah, and more than that, they require competence. Yeah, they require competence.
Absolutely. So,
and I love your thesis. We definitely need to do something about the infrastructure. We definitely need to do something about hardening our defenses, our digital defenses, et cetera. Folks, the book is The Fifth Horseman and the New MAD, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large. Sounds like a must read to me. Find it on Amazon. Dr. Harlan Ullman, you can find on atthehill.com, on LinkedIn. He's Harlan Ullman, H-A-R-L-A-N-U-L-L-M-A-N. On Twitter, he's Harmon K. Ullman. And again, the book on Amazon, The Fifth Horseman, The New MAD. Thank you, Dr. Ullman. It's been a fascinating conversation. I love your prescription of having a CEO and a CFO. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Folks, that's it. We had two great military men. One is involved with hardening our digital infrastructure.